Welcome. We're glad you've joined us for this Hand in Hand podcast. Hand in Hand is a nonprofit organization, and we provide information, classes, training, and lots of support for parents like you. We call our approach Parenting by Connection, and it's based on the insight that you deserve good support as you parent, and every child needs lots of connection in order to thrive. We offer tools to help you foster support for yourself and connection in your family. We hope this podcast gives you exactly the kind of support you're looking for.
I want to warmly welcome you to our Hand in Hand presentation today. We're just about ready to get started. There will be more people calling in. So as people call in, we have about 80 people registered today. More people will be calling in. I just wanted to give you a little bit of background about hand-in-hand parenting. We know your time is precious, and we know how challenging parenting can be. So really, really want to thank you for taking time out of your busy day to join us. And also want to congratulate you for the hard work you're doing every day as a parent. We'd really like to support you with the work you're doing in parenting, and we hope to be able to give you some ideas today that you can use at home with your family before and after doctor's visits and even in the doctor's office. So I want to let you know about Hand in Hand. It's a nonprofit organization based in California with instructors from all over the world, including myself, Jackie Long, and my co-presenter, Pamela Otis. Hand in Hand was founded about 30 years ago by Patty Whistler, who has wonderful insights about the emotional needs of children based on many years of real-life experience. And I, as a therapist, haven't found tools more helpful for parents and children than the Parenting by Connection tools. Hand in Hand brings parents information, tools, and lots of support for the vital work of parenting. We know that the work of nurturing children can't be easily done in isolation. And Hand in Hand has a variety of offerings designed to support you with free articles on the website. There's free teleseminars like this one. There's even an online discussion group and free access to an inspiring blog with many, many success stories from parents based on this approach. And besides the free resources, Hand in Hand also offers podcasts, classes, and support groups, both in person and online. There's intensive trainings for parents and professionals and consultations for one-on-one support. And you can find all of these resources through the Hand in Hand website. If you have any trouble finding anything you need on the website, always feel free to contact us. Hand in Hand's approach in all of these offerings is called Parenting by Connection. You might also hear it referred to as PBC, Parenting by Connection. And there are four main ideas behind this approach. The first is that we parents need and deserve support for the emotional, challenging work of parenting. We can build that support and have much more success meeting both our own needs and our children's needs. And the second is that our children are born to feel connected with us. This sense of connection is what they need in order to learn and to build friendships and to build resilience and confidence as they grow. And third, when our children don't feel connected, their behavior goes off track, and we like to refer it to off-track behavior, which is a signal to us that they need our help. And fourth, when we foster laughter and play, and we prefer to do this without tickling, when we set limits without harshness, and when we support children to have good, hearty cries and even tantrums, it helps our children feel more fully connected to us. And it helps them leave difficult behaviors behind them. So Hand in Hand helps parents strengthen and rebuild the parent-child connection with all of its tools so we can feel successful as we love our children and so our children can thrive on the love we have for them. So that's a little overview of Hand in Hand as more callers are calling in. And now Pamela and I would really like to warmly welcome all of you who are here joining us today for this teleseminar on doctor's visits, supporting our children with doctor's visits before and during and after the visit to the doctor. We want to really congratulate you for the hard work of parenting that you're doing every day and congratulate you for the love you give your children. So we'll be talking for about 30 minutes, and then at the end of our talk, we would really like to hear from you, any questions you have regarding doctor's visits. Pamela has 12 years of working with parents and their questions and in a very direct way, many, many years of being a pediatrician beyond that. So we really want to hear from you and your questions and look forward to responding to them. So my name is Jackie Long, and I'm a marriage and family therapist. And I work in Los Altos, Palo Alto area, and I'm a Parenting by Connection instructor. And I've used these tools in my own life and my personal life since my son was born. Luckily, I was trained in Parenting by Connection before my son was born and had the benefit of using these tools from day one, which I know is rare and feel really grateful for that. I've also been able to implement these tools in my private practice as a marriage and family therapist, and again, I have found no tools more helpful than these in eliciting change and helping parents and children connect. So I'd also like to warmly introduce Pamela Otis from Ohio. She's a lovely pediatrician who cares deeply about supporting children and parents in the office, at the doctor's office. And Pamela, would you like to say a little bit more about yourself?
Oh, thank you, Jackie. Thank you very much. Yes, I do have a deep regard, respect, and love for those of us who have chosen or found ourselves to be parents. And it's really an honor to get to do this in the hand-in-hand context. I've been a primary care pediatrician working in Central City, urban neighborhood for 25 years. And I have done hospital-based medicine during that time, and since that time, the last 7 years, building up a hospital-based system taking care of children with complex illness. And I've used the hand-in-hand tools both as a practitioner in the outpatient and inpatient arena for medicine, and as a mother. I am a mother of two adopted sons and one foster son in the middle of the between the two adopted children. So I've used hand in hand since before they were born through their current lives and have found it invaluable. It is the tool that I have used as a pediatrician for emotional behavioral emotional social issues with families. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Pam. We're really lucky to have you with us today, and I feel so grateful that you're taking your time to share your information and all of the wealth of your experience with these parents who are calling in today. Thank you for being here. So I'll offer a little overview of these wonderful Parenting by Connection tools that Patty's developed. And there are six basic tools in Parenting by Connection. And they all involve some form of emotional attunement or listening. So they're called listening tools. And I'll list them. So the six tools are special time, play listening, stay listening, warm limit setting, and listening partnerships, and support group. So we're going to give you a very brief overview of these tools, just basically definitions. And then I'll share a little anecdote that can help to illustrate them or bring them to life. So special time is a practice of setting up one-on-one time with our child or our children to bring our full attention and extra enthusiasm to our children's self-directed play. It's a time when we get down to their level, let them lead, and we follow with extra excitement, more than we can normally muster because we have 12 other things to do in the moment. So this special time helps us build connection with our kids. It builds rapport and cooperation, and it also helps them develop the safety they need to eventually share their big feelings with us when they need to. It's kind of like putting money in the bank. And then there's play listening, and play listening is a practice of playing the goofy, incompetent adult. We engage in dramatic play that helps our kids laugh. And when we find that laughter, it's helpful for us to repeat it again and again as the child releases wave after wave of tension in their deep laughter, utter delight, and sense of relative competency as compared to our very dramatic and goofy incompetence. And there's stay listening. And stay listening is a practice of coming close, staying calm, and listening with warm confidence to our children as their big feelings come crashing out. It's about turning toward the big feelings instead of turning away from them and offering our grounded presence as an emotional anchor instead of withdrawing our attention and affection during our children's emotional upset. And stay listening builds safety and trust and connection. It also helps children think clearly and think well again, and they often cooperate more afterwards. Their bodies are more relaxed. And then there's warm limits or limit setting, and it's a practice of coming close, staying calm, and using a warm tone as we bring a limit to our children. We practice setting the limit in a kind yet clear way, and while we put a limit on the off-track behavior, we allow for the feelings that follow. We listen to the feelings that come pouring out when our kids don't get to do what they want. So with warm limits, the motto is connect before you direct. And we also like to say it hand in hand, listen, limit, listen. So we listen to their feelings, we set the limit, we listen to the feelings, and so on. We practice using very few words as we set the limit, just one or two or three words like, nope, no, sweetie. And then the last two tools are for the parent, and this is what I think is often left out of other parenting approaches, and what I really love about hand-in-hand parenting is that there's tools for the parent's emotional needs as well. And one of the tools is listening partnerships, which is a practice of setting up listening time with another parent each week. One parent speaks and the other listens with warmth and curiosity, without offering any advice or suggestions. And then we switch. It helps us parents offload our own emotional attention, which helps us think more clearly again and be more present and able to give our best and deepest selves to our children. And then there's the support group, and it's a time to gather with other moms and dads to connect with our own feelings and offload stress, to really listen to each other without giving advice or suggestions, which is really great practice because it's so common in our culture. And to recognize that we all have challenges and we're all struggling in our own ways. To realize that we're not alone in the challenges of parenthood. And there's nothing wrong with us for having these hard times that we move through. So that's an overview of the tools of hand-in-hand parenting. And if you want to find out more, I highly recommend taking a starter class or even a parenting intensive. Really, really beneficial tools that are nuanced, that we can learn to apply in our own unique ways to our own unique children. Anything you want to say about that, Pam, before I continue?
No, that was magnificent. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Okay. So before I share my own story, my own little anecdote to help bring these tools together, I do want to say that today we're going to be talking a little bit about medical checkups for our children, which often include vaccinations. And I'd like to say that Hand in Hand is not taking a position on vaccinations. What we do know is that when strong emotions rise, it's hard for children to think well. And we believe every parent needs to take listening time on the feelings they have around vaccinations. And we want to support parents in doing their own research. Our listening tools are here to support all parents. If your child is receiving immunizations, our tools can help. So we really, really want to encourage parents to think well and think clearly and make their own decisions around that. So I'll share a little bit about my son's experience with vaccinations. He has some sensory differences. He's a very sensitive child in terms of sensory stuff. And vaccinations were always really challenging for him. And we found that when he was young, you know, as soon as he went into the doctor's office, he would start crying. So I started to practice the listening tools before we went to the doctor's office. I found that it really helped me to work with my listening partner to process some of my own feelings that were coming up around my son getting vaccines. It helped me offload some emotional tension ahead of time so that when I was in the doctor's office, I could be a real grounded support for my son. And I could be like that calm, confident mama for him and really be there for him because my own feelings had been offloaded quite a bit already. And when I would work with my listening partner, I would work with my feelings about him, you know, having this experience in the doctor's office that was clearly really, really hard for his sensitive body. And I would also work on the feelings that came up when I was a little girl and I had my own shots that I didn't want. So there's a couple of different places to work. Another area that I worked on in my listening partnerships was talking to the doctor because we decided to do an alternative vaccination schedule. And I often needed to advocate for that. So I would work in my listening partnership about some of the feelings that came up about going against what the doctors were encouraging me to do. And that was helpful for me. And then in terms of working with my son beforehand, I would let my son know several days ahead of time that we were going to go to the doctor's office to get him a shot. When he was younger, I forgot to do this. I kind of neglected to do this. And it's helpful to let even really little ones, even little babies know ahead of time. But I didn't do that. And I realized as he got older that that was a really helpful step. I thought I was kind of saving him pain by telling him last minute in the car ride over. But I realized that it was helpful to give him time ahead of time to process and digest the information, to let him know really clearly what's going to be coming up. And then we could do some play around it to offload tension. So we bought little toy syringes and he would pretend to give me a shot and I would object ferociously, and we would do some play listening around it. So he had all the power, and I was the incompetent, goofy one. And I would also do a whole bunch of special time with him on the days leading up to the shots. Even so, when we got to the doctor's office, my son still was really agitated and scared, and I would advocate with the nurse who was giving him the shot to please not distract him from his feelings after the shot. I asked them to please not give him a sticker or a lollipop right away because I wanted him to have time to get his feelings out, to get the hurt out as I poured my love in. And I found that I was respected with this, and that was helpful. It was empowering for me to ask for what I thought was best for my child and to receive that. And so after we got the vaccination, my son cried and cried and cried, and I stayed present, and I just said, he's safe. I said, you're safe, sweetie. I'm right here. And I gave him all the space he needed to get his feelings out. Then afterwards, a few days after, actually, my son and I were doing some special time together, and he grabbed a shark, and he made his shark kind of swim towards me and touch my neck, and I made a dramatic attempt to get the shark off of me. But as hard as I tried, I just couldn't seem to break free of the shark bite. So I was being very playful with it. And my son laughed and laughed, so I knew I was onto something useful for him. And I laid down on the ground, and I stuck out my tongue, and I made convulsions with my body as I said, help me. Jackson laughed a bit. And after he laughed a bit, he came over to me, and he made a little sound as he touched me, and he said, schwa. And he told me that it was healing energy. And when I came back to life, he was ready to do it again, and he had the shark swim towards me. And so he repeated this several times that morning. And after at least 8 more times repeating the same thing with him touching the shark on my neck, he started making the shark attack my leg instead of my neck. And he placed the shark in the same place on my leg where he had gotten his vaccination a couple of days before. And my hunch was that he was working on healing the hurts from his vaccines. seemed pretty clear that he still had some feelings about being the hurt one who didn't have any power in the doctor's office. And he was making good use of our playtime to heal those hurts as I became the hurt one. I became the hurt one who didn't have any power. And he became the powerful one who could control and kind of heal the hurt. So here in our game, he had all the power. He had the power to choose where the pain was placed, when it was applied. And he also had the power to heal me, to take the pain away. So this special time afforded me the opportunity to help him take his power back. And this play listening, me being the goofy and confident one, gave me the opportunity to help my son shed tension as he laughed his pain away. So I hope this shows how helpful these tools can be in conjunction with each other. They're really meant to be integrated tools, to be tools that work together and support each other in the work of helping us shed our own emotional tension around doctor's visits and also our children's emotional tension. So thank you for listening, and Pam, I'd love to invite you to share a little bit from your end as a pediatrician about visits to the doctor.
Great. Thank you so much, Jackie. That was a good summary of the listening tools and certainly of your use of them in your family.
As a
pediatrician, I've done my best to give those listening tools that you so beautifully described to each of my families so that the visits could be easier on the parents as well as on the young people. And I look forward to being able to do that with the people on the phone today and more in the future. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And I do want to just restate reminding us that there's no more important work in the world than being parents. So congratulations and thank you very, very much for doing that work, all of us. I suspect that our children are growing, playing, learning, sleeping, eating, at least moderately well, some every day. So congratulations. And at the same time, I imagine that our children, your children, just like mine and Jackie's, have tantrums, they cry, they make messes too. And all that is just as well. That's normal. Those are good aspects of what it is to be full human beings. So when we take a baby or a toddler, even a young school-aged child, to the doctor for an appointment, it's not surprising that they would cry at some point during that visit. It may be a shot. It may be having to have their blood drawn at some point, or maybe even it's just the physical exam itself. I want to start by focusing on crying being a normal key process for emotional and physical healing. That good babies cry, and when our babies cry, it's a sign of their ability to offload. They're asking for attention, connection, and exercising their ability to heal from an upset. So as Jackie described, we get to listen with respect, kindness, tenderness, warmth. And I always enjoyed asking parents when their baby started to cry, and the parents obviously felt uncomfortable, like they should have their baby be quiet. And I liked asking the parents, how different would your life be if you had had a chance to cry when you thought that someone was mistreating you, when you thought someone was treating you in a way that was upsetting? How much different would our lives be? And lots of those moms looked at me and shook their head with understanding. Their lives would be really different if we'd had a chance to cry too. So I congratulate parents when their babies cry, that this is a healthy, good thing, and that we get to stay and listen with a few words and be honest about the fact that something is going to hurt or did hurt, and that we'll stay while the child shows their upset. Pain from a shot or from any kind of injury, a skinned knee, a twisted ankle, pain heals with tears and often some trembling from feeling a little bit scared. And I think what we've learned with Hand in Hand is that stopping the tears and trembling doesn't actually stop the pain, but stops the healing. The pain happened. The shot happened. The skinned knee happened. The blood draw happened. But if the emotional content gets bottled up, it grows. It keeps bottling up until we have a chance to offload it and heal it with tears, trembling, and certainly laughter, as Jackie described, from our light fears. I remember a one-year-old girl who started coming to me when her grandmother obtained custody, and there had been some challenges for her mom and her dad early on in her life, and she hadn't gotten regular medical care, and we did a thorough investigation and gradually started immunizing her as a one-year-old. I certainly allowed her to cry it through in the exam room, encouraged her grandmother to do that at home as well, and she came back pretty regularly for quite a few months to do all the things that we needed to do for her. And her grandmother described her crying hard from the minute they drove into the parking lot until she left. And we as a medical staff and her grandmother were warm and calm and welcoming and assuring and pleased with how well they were doing. And after actually probably 4 or 5 visits, the tears actually subsided, and I'll never forget, this was years ago, but I still remember her being animated and smiling and laughing and playful for the entire visit. She cried a bit after a shot, but after a couple minutes of crying, it wasn't even probably a couple of minutes, it was more brief than that, she noticed something, got engaged, and started to play. So it's possible to see changes as these feelings get a chance to offload. And as a medical provider, I as a physician and nurses are now expected to eliminate pain. Our whole attitude toward pain has been changed in something that we aren't supposed to cause. Ever at all. And I think it's helpful to realize that pain is actually a normal physiologic protective mechanism that's not destructive in a small wound or a shot or a blood draw in healthy children. We all have lots of feelings about pain that we can notice, and we as adults can talk about, laugh about, cry about in our own listening partnerships. But as we as adults can look at our feelings about pain, we can be a little bit more relaxed and be able to think more clearly about our children's response to pain. It's actually a protective mechanism. We have a lot more pain fibers where we have vital organs, which is a very good thing. So I think that Jackie's description of talking about the visit before it happens, so being able to plan for the physician visit is excellent. And including babies, to be able to say to the baby, we are going to go to the doctor's office, you will have all your clothes taken off, including your diaper, and be put on sort of a cold scale that won't be very pleasant. And then we'll put your diaper back on and I will hold you close, but to go through the very specific steps, so that children can be informed. Information is power, and we all feel less powerful when we are at a doctor's office or at school. There are many places where we are put into less powerful positions, and anything we can do to equalize that is important for it to go well. So knowing the flow of what will happen is not an unreasonable request, and it's a good thing for parents to have their own listening partnerships about, so that we can think through the visit for ourselves and then be able to think through the visit as allies and advocates for our young ones. As Jackie described, setting up special time before the visit and noticing what generates laughter and being able to repeat that with a child doing play listening builds connection. It fills them with us. It fills them with their mom or their dad, their loved one, as they have a chance to offload feelings and be prepared for what's coming. These virtual shots that are administered to parents with vengeance, glee, timidity, where the toddler has the upper hand and we as parents can moan and plead not to have a shot and try and get away and have pretend tears can be very, very helpful offloading for the young ones. The visit itself is an opportunity for us as parents to bring advocacy to our child, and over time, and this is something we'll probably get to a little bit more in the future, being advocates for the medical profession as well, building an alliance with doctors and nurses. And I want to remind us that close physical contact with our children in the doctor's office is very important, especially with the infants and even toddlers. So skin-to-skin contact with that baby is a great thing. And request that the exam be done on your lap as much as possible. And there should be a complete physical exam. But the stethoscope doesn't need to come between the infant and the parent that's there with the infant or toddler. The child can move around, and the stethoscope can stay on the outside, not coming between the baby and the parent. And even for the abdominal exam for a baby on a parent's lap, if the parent's legs and thighs are close together, that can be a firm enough surface to do a sufficient abdominal exam. And the ear exam is always a good one. It can be done safely in parents' arms if parents can hold the baby securely and the physician can secure the infant's head. That can be done on a lap. And if the physician needs to do that on the exam table, that's certainly doable. Be prepared for that baby or that toddler to cry and just know that it's okay, that no one's done anything wrong. It's a very healthy sign. After the visit at home over several days, notice that off-track behavior. Notice behavior that your child knows isn't okay, whatever it is. Demand for more screen time or heading to the wall with a crayon, mistreating siblings. They're asking for help. They're asking for help with feelings maybe connected to that doctor's visit. So again, listening partnership time for ourselves, for our own feelings, and then being able to stay listen and do play listening as it evolves, and certainly special time works well. So bookending our medical appointments with listening partnership for myself as a mother, with special time, stay listening before the visit, stay listening during the visit, and then again, bookending finally after the visit with listening partnership for me, the mother, special time, more stay listening, can offload the feelings, and rather than seeing an escalation of upset with doctor's appointments, we can gradually see over time, hopefully a de-escalation of the amount of feelings associated with those visits as children have more sense of connection and information, which is power, that they get to have during those visits. So I think that's enough for me to just say, and what we'd like to do now is open this to questions from any of you that are on the line. If you have a question, we'd like to hear from it, and Jackie's going to hear from you, and Jackie's going to tell you how to do that.
Great. Thank you so much, Pam, for sharing your experience with working with so many families over the last 25 years. It's really lovely to hear such a heart-based approach to working with kids and families. Thank you so much.
Sure.
So, yes, if anyone has questions, you can press star 2 to kind of raise your hand and let us know you have a question. And then once we see that you've raised your hand, I can unmute your particular phone line so you can ask the question. So if you have a question you'd like to ask Pam, just press star 2, and that will let us know. We do have some questions that have come in over email in the last few days that we'll address as well, but we'd like to hear from you first, our callers first. So we do have a call here from Sunnyvale, California, so I'm going to unmute your line. So the person calling from Sunnyvale, California, would you like to say your name?
I'm wondering if that would be me.
Yes, that's you.
Oh, hello. Good. Okay. I didn't even know my line was from Sunnyvale, but okay, good to know. This is Norma. Good morning. I do have
Hi,
a
Norma.
Question. I jumped in a little late because I have a toddler and just running around. But and I don't know if you guys covered this, but my baby has been particularly extremely scared since he had to get blood drawn from for the insurance. I guess they want to check if there's lead in the blood or in the system. And it was a traumatic experience for him. He's never been actually, you know, too warm with doctors. He always or nurses, he would always cry. But this is really, really something. Since he was a little bigger, so this was about gosh, he was probably like 13 months when this happened. He's 16 months right now, and yeah, he's still, as soon as we walk into any doctor's office, he just clings on to me with all his little might, and I don't know how to ease him from this.
Yeah, great question.
That is a wonderful question, and I want to assure you that having blood drawn for children who have chronic illness and have many, many, many different procedures done, the one they remember being the worst is having their blood drawn. So it sounds like something minor, but in fact, it can be quite painful, particularly if the person drawing the blood is not familiar with drawing blood on children, and especially 1-year-olds through toddler times have sort of pudgy arms, and it's sometimes hard to find the vein. So he has a perfectly reasonable upset over that experience. And I would say that when he cries over anything, it will probably appear to be completely unrelated. But when he shows upset over something, and you obviously love him, you are doing your best to fill his needs. And when you think he has a need for something and you fill it, but then he continues to be fussy and you try again and think, well, maybe he didn't want this, he wanted that, and you try again. And after 2 or 3 tries of thinking you are fulfilling his need and it doesn't, it's okay to actually hold him and let him have some really big cries. One of the challenges with this age group is, and actually with all of us in every age group, is we can't always identify. He can't explain to you, Mommy, I need to cry about that shot. But he will cry over something that appears unrelated, and he may get very sweaty. He may struggle hard, sort of fight hard. And cry hard, really hard. And I would just welcome you, invite you to hold him warmly, but firmly. Don't let him fling himself out of your arms, but maybe even lying on the floor or lying on the bed next to him, and let him have some really big cries. And then see if that can gradually subside, if you see a gradual subsiding of his anxiety when he goes into the doctor's office. But it's going to take some big, hearty cries for him to have a chance to offload the fear. And he may do some trembling while he's crying as well. Struggling hard, crying, sweating, and shaking some, because it's also some fear often gets connected in there when that painful experience happens. And I would also suggest that you have a chance to have partnership so that you have a place to talk about what it's like for you, what that experience was like for you, what your own experiences with having had painful procedures done, and what it's like being with him when he has these big, hard cries, because we all have a lot of feelings about that as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's really hard. I don't know if it's harder for him or myself. It's, it's bad. Okay. Well, so I guess it's just trying to comfort him, because he's a contact person. He gets comforted by me hugging him and holding him, so I try to do that as much as possible. So I guess it's just letting him cry it out, and eventually, is what I'm hearing, that this will go subside.
Exactly. Okay. Holding him close, a lot of good physical close contact is wonderful, and he needs a chance to have the big cries. And when he's having a big cry, and if you notice you with a lump in your throat and tears in your own eyes, it's okay to cry with him. That's okay. You can have a little tears with him as well. Lots of us do that. Yep.
I thought I was the only one.
Oh, no.
Okay, well, that's good to hear.
That's how much we love him.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. All right. Yes, go ahead.
It looks from our little teleseminar talk time here, it looks like you came on after I shared my own anecdote about bringing my son to the doctor's office, and I shared a lot of information that might be helpful for you. Yeah. So you'll be getting a link in an email. Everyone who came to register will be getting a link. So I just invite you to listen to that.
Okay.
You can just play it anytime you want to listen to it, and while you're playing with your baby, you can just have it on. So it can give you some tips and some little ideas ahead of time before the next doctor's visit to prepare, to help you prepare, but also to help your son prepare. And something I didn't mention in my anecdote is that D.W. Winnicott said that without the mother, there would be no baby. Without a baby, without the mother, there'd be no baby. And Beth O'Hannison, one of our hand-in-hand instructors, said, without a community, there would be no mother. Without a community, there would be no mother. So I really am a big proponent of asking someone in your life, like a good friend or family member, to come to the doctor's office with you and be there for you, not for the baby, but for you. So when the baby starts clinging onto you, it's probably going to happen again, no matter how much you prepare, to ask that person to put their hand on your shoulder and to whisper in your ear, I'm here for you, Mama. I'm right here. You're doing good work. So that they can help, give you messages of safety and connection, so that you can give that message to your child. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Yeah, it does, actually.
Great.
Yes, it does make sense.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
All right. Well, that was my question. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for the question.
Mm-hmm.
So we have another question from someone from Ohio. California. We don't have a name associated with this caller, and you might not be living in Ohio right now, but I think it was our first caller. So I'm going to unmute you.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
What's your name?
Let's
see your first name. Julie, welcome. Do you have a
question
for us today?
Yeah, I actually had emailed it in, too,
great.
And it was about when the parent is having a hard time with the doctor's visits, because my son has congenital hypothyroidism, and which was not diagnosed by the doctors, even though I kept repeatedly going to them so to find out. And then when he was a week old, he was hospitalized for spinal meningitis, and I had at the time had a 2-year-old, and it's like every time I go to the doctor, now he's 6, the baby, and I still have a hard time every time I go to the doctor's office and even just talking about it. And so I'm wondering how I can get, because my son with the blood draws, it's very frequent, and I'm the one that has a hard time. So how can I get myself to that place of calm is my question.
Great question.
So, Julie, thank you for being a mom of a child with complex illness, and thanks for your question. And I didn't say in my introduction that I have a son with complex, potentially life-threatening illness as well. And I will say that probably the most important thing I did for his health was my listening partnership time. That I developed, my husband and I use listening partnership, my neighbor, several of my friends, especially during the acute phase of his issues, I developed listening partnerships with lots of people. And I cried and cried and cried and cried and cried and cried. And know that we're now at 20 years later, and I've cleaned up a lot of my own issues with my own early childhood illness, but probably the biggest thing was seeing this beloved child of mine go through such hard things, and the upsets. Yes, of course, I had the same upsets with physicians who misdiagnosed and abandoned me, and so lots and lots and lots of feelings. So listening partnership was what I did, and I invite you to develop listening partnership with someone who you already maybe are already close to or already friends with, someone who can listen to you already pretty well, and take turns listening to each other. Don't give advice. Don't say everything's going to be okay. Don't say I understand. No, the person just can listen and love you and respect you. And it helps if they can hold confidence, so the things that you say in that listening time, you don't hear from somebody else that you didn't actually decide that you wanted to tell, if they can keep confidentiality. And you deserve a place to offload how hard this has been for you, Julie, for sure.
Do you think that would be enough to be able to then go back to a state of calm when dealing with this?
It won't happen in one listening partnership. It will happen over weeks, months, years.
Okay.
I'm 20 years out, and I still practice. I still use my listening partnerships every week, multiple listening partnerships every week. I'm no longer dealing with the acute issue of his illness, but we still interface with the medical system, and I still need to do it respectfully, but as an advocate, and that's a delicate balance. That's a delicate balance. So yes, it's an ongoing process, this emotional healing, ongoing process.
Okay, that's very helpful.
Yeah, and I do believe you can do it.
What'd you say?
And I do think you can do it. I think you can come to a place of resolution.
Okay, good. And I like the idea of having somebody there for me at the doctor's visit, because I'm like, my son is fine. He's totally stamped with all of it. And I'm the one, like, bawling after we're done.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yep. Yep. You have all the right parts to be have a great listening partnership. It will help.
Okay. Yeah. I'll do that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah.
I actually want to say before we close the question, Pam, I imagine that there were probably some things in particular that were really helpful for you in listening partnership around helping to clear and offload some of the feelings that came up around interfacing with the medical professionals you were working with, issues of kind of power and authority. I'm wondering if you can name or identify a couple of the things that were particularly helpful for you. Like for some of us, it's using the body. When I feel scared about talking to someone in authority, and I know I'm going to have to, advocate for my son or talk to someone even unrelated to my son, but someone in authority, I might go into that feeling more fully and allow myself to shake a little bit, or even say, I'm scared, and just let myself feel the feelings that are associated with that state. And as I'm feeling it, I might shake my hands or my arm. Sometimes my jaw will shake a little bit. And it can feel uncomfortable at first when we're starting to let the feelings come through the body more. But the body is such a friend or an ally for us in offloading these feelings. So if there can be a way to invite the body in as an ally for processing the feelings and digesting the feelings, it can help to clear them a lot more quickly. So I think of it as a facilitator of the release of the feelings, so we can find that place of calm more slowly. I know that in listening partnerships, sometimes if you can have a listening partnership face-to-face, it's helpful to have someone say, like, I am that doctor, stand tall and put your hands on mine and press into my hands and just look in my eyes and say no. And that alone can help, elicit the body and the body's response in processing these feelings, and also finding a place of power in the body. So those are some ideas. Anything that you want to say about that, Pam, for this caller your own experience?
I think that's very good information, Jackie. And I think also to trust the feelings, the thoughts that come to our mind, and that which may not seem to make any sense, but if they're in my mind and weighing on me, then it makes sense for me to say them. Trust that. And again, this is why I think confidentiality and building safety is so important, that I needed to face the fact that I was terrified that my son was going to die. And that seemed uncomfortable to some people, but those are the feelings that I needed to face and cry about. And to the extent I could, I was much more relaxed around him. My worry wasn't aimed at him. My upset wasn't aimed at him. So I think just to trust the tears, trust the what comes into our minds and our bodies both. Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Jackie.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah. Beautiful allies on the path of advocating for our children and helping to shed the tension and trust ourselves moving forward. Really nice. Thank you so much. Okay, so we do have another caller from Seattle, Washington. Kiono? Stephen. It might not be.
Hello.
There you go. I just unmuted you. Yes. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. This is Susan.
Susan. Okay.
Yeah. Stephen's my husband.
Got it. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you. I have a 10-year-old who really doesn't want shots for a blood draw or a vaccination, and he's got going to have another one coming up. And my question is around the issue of, so if you have a child who's really scared of the pain of a shot and a blood draw, and that it needs to be done, if you don't get there, if they don't release enough feelings ahead of time or during to cooperate, mm-hmm. and they want to get away, they don't want to do it, they don't want to cooperate, you mm-hmm. then have a choice of either trying to, you know, hold them firmly enough that it can happen anyway, or it doesn't happen. And you know, maybe that's an option is to come back another time. You know, with a 2-year-old, it's, I guess I want to hear what you have to say both for younger children and for older children who are much stronger. Mm-hmm. The issue of overpowering, and if you need to do that, healing from that, how do you do that with older children?
Mm. Great question, Susan. And I would say with older children that it would be difficult to do it safely with a 10-year-old who has strength. I'm not going to say it isn't doable, but it would be difficult to do it safely with that size child for either a blood draw or an immunization. And I think one of the things that I found with older children is if they can be standing up, obviously to be doing the lots and lots and lots of play listening ahead of time and special time ahead of time so that and to talk through how it can happen and to get the 10-year-old, to get your son's ideas about how it could work. He may have ideas, well, if we can do it this way, we can set that up. He may very well have ideas about how it can go better for him. And obviously to give those a try. But I think to try and, physically restrain him, would be difficult to do safely. And there are nurses and physicians who are better at this than others who can be very quick, which can also help so that he doesn't have to sit still for 5 minutes in order to get a shot, but that it can be, with his agreement and planning, it's we do this, we do this, we do the shot, it's over. It can be quickly done, and you know the people really good at giving injections, it really doesn't hurt like we remember it hurting when we're little. When we're bigger, it's not as painful because there's more tissue. So that would be I as a clinician would be reticent to do shot or blood draw by restraining a 10-year-old. I think it would be challenging safely. And I think with the younger children, it's doable. And again, with an older child, if that restraint can be part of physical closeness with a parent, for example, sitting on a parent's lap, maybe sideways on a parent's lap and having the child have a chance to hold the parent, with one arm down with a 10-year-old, injections will likely go in his arm rather than in the leg. So he could be sitting on a parent's lap with a lot of contact, and if he would like, the parent can put their leg over his legs so that his legs are sort of between the parent's legs. This can be done with a smaller child as well. But then there can be a lot of physical contact, so a lot of safety. And again, a nurse or physician who's quick can do that shot very quickly once he's there and ready. So it isn't full restraint. He's cooperating. He's setting it up on a parent's lap. And that would be the way I would do it with a child, a toddler, say, who's wanting to is crying and kicking, and I think it's okay to hold that child close. And the important thing is stay listening, and let them cry and fight and cry and fight and cry and fight. Afterward, and then have plenty of stay listening and play listening later. That the shot itself can be done actually very, very quickly.
Thank you so much. That was really helpful.
Good. Jackie, do you have anything to add?
I think really useful question around consent, kind of these little ones and bigger ones. So I'm glad that you brought this up, Susan. It's a really interesting topic, and I think one little piece that could also be useful is to, or at least that was helpful for my son, was to give him a slight little bit of choice, like. You know, I told him we do need to get this one shot today, and you get to decide where you want it. Do you want it in your leg or this arm or that arm? And he, my son, this might not be true for everybody, but my son felt really empowered with that choice. It was helpful. So I'm not sure if it will help your children, but talking about it ahead of time and giving that choice ahead of time when the feelings aren't so foreground could be helpful, just to give a little bit of empowerment during the actual event.
Yeah, that's helpful too. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Jackie, I think that is important in the choice where and when. They may want to get the shot the minute they walk in. Let's just do it. When I first get to the office, and that would be a fine thing to let the to let the office know ahead of time that we are going to do the shots up front. And the only thing they'll want to do is be sure he's not deathly ill. But a little fever is, again, a little illness is not a reason to miss shots. So, yes, I think information and choice are very important parts of this. Yep.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. So we're going to wrap it up soon, but we do have this one question that came to us through email that I wanted to share with you, Pam, to see if you have any thoughts about this, and then we'll bring our time together to a close. So this question came in. My preteen daughter, and sorry, I just also want to say that I think it's connected to what Susan was saying about consent. So my preteen daughter had a doctor visit recently with a new doctor. During the exam, the doctor quickly told my daughter that she had to look up my daughter's shirt and down her pants to make sure everything was okay. It all happened so fast, my daughter didn't really have time to consent. I could see on her face she was surprised and unsure, but she went along with it. After we left the office, my daughter and I talked about it and how it felt awkward, and she was able to laugh a little to relieve the tension she felt. But I'm still left wondering, is there more I need to do here to address what she felt? And any tips on handling future visits? It was our first time at this doctor, so I was a little unprepared for her style. Though she was very nice, it did feel a bit more invasive than our old doctor. So there's two questions. Is there anything I need to do here to address what my daughter felt? And any tips on handling future visits?
Again, a great question. The fact that your daughter's been able to giggle some is terrific, and if it's possible to do some play listening on this with her, I would strongly recommend it. And you know, something as light as looking down, you know, your own shirt, you know, just a sort of playful looking down my own shirt or acting silly about that and being very, very thoughtful of her so that we're not increasing the embarrassment and awkwardness so that it would want to be targeted at me, the parent. And I think asking her about it, asking her what her thoughts are, how she would want to do it differently, and if again, if it can be woven into some play listening about that doctor, what does she think about that doctor, and what an odd, I mean, in a sense, what an odd way of approaching a physical exam. And I do want to own my beloved professionals. We need to not assume that people who go through medical school and residency training learn anything about emotions or feelings, and we are have every bit as many feelings of awkwardness and embarrassment that we haven't, for the most part, had a chance to offload, address, look at. And what preteen, teenage, young woman doesn't have a lot of accumulated embarrassment? And so that's true of pediatricians and internists as well, that embarrassment is there. Mm-hmm. So doing a physical exam on a teenager is different than doing it on a one-year-old or two-year-old, a lot because of the feelings that we as the providers bring. And I do want to say that a physical exam on a preteen and teenager is a very important part of the visit, and it can be done with information and respect. So I would suggest that as you have a conversation with your daughter about the fact that a physical exam is necessary, as shots are necessary when a family decides they're going to be doing immunizations, that we explain this is a necessary process, not something we necessarily like a car seat or taking a bath, but we will be doing it, and you don't have to like it, but we do get to have some say over how it happens. And I would have some conversation with your daughter about how she could imagine this being okay. How would she want it set up? I would imagine the clinician has gowns for the patients to wear, and it should be a different gown than the one that the toddler wears or the six-year-old wears. It needs to be longer. It needs to be fit for that age group. And she can wear two gowns if she wants. She can bring in sweatpants if she wants. She can set up the exam the way she wants it. I used to do exams on teenagers and explain to them that I needed to examine them and that it was their body. It's a great educational tool to say, this is your body. We need to do this together. I want you to have information about your body, be able to ask questions, assure you of things that are healthy about your body, and be able to look at breasts one at a time with just showing a part of it at a time so that, you know, a child doesn't need to lie there completely exposed, that we can cover everything but just what needs to be looked at, and I can do that very, very discreetly and thoughtfully. So, again, that's something that the parent and daughter can talk about and probably do some coaching with the practitioner, again, ahead of time. That's a conversation that the mother can have. And a lot of practitioners have online communication available. So through MyChart or some kind of communication to have that clarified before they go in the next time so that everybody knows what to expect.
Yes. Yes, I do know a mom who regularly has advocated with her doctor to let her doctor know that she prefers the doctor to wait until her daughter's ready for the procedure, whatever it is, whether it's a swab or even an ear check, an ear exam. So I know that I had a doctor when my son was very young who she would say, I'm going to check your ears now. And she, her hands were moving towards his ears as she was saying it. And the next time we had a doctor, the doctor had her hands in her lap and she was maybe, you know, 3 feet away. And she said, I'll be doing an ear exam now, you know, basically the same words, but her hands were at her own lap. With the first doctor, my son withdrew, kind of leaned away from the doctor as the hands were coming towards him. And with the second doctor, he leaned toward her and he expressed mm-hmm. readiness. And it seemed like it was because she just waited a moment before moving towards him. So luckily I didn't have to advocate for that, but because the second doctor was doing it just naturally. But honestly, I didn't even know that that was something that would be useful for my son had I not had the experience with the second doctor. So if I were to have a doctor who just moves in quickly, I would in the future, I would say, actually, I would like just another moment so that my child is ready for this procedure. So I would advocate for that in the doctor's office real time. However, you know, sometimes this is a learning process for us as parents, and I think it's important for us to be kind about ourselves as we're learning about these things. And I really appreciate, Pamela, that as a doctor, as a physician, you're advocating for us as parents to communicate with our doctors ahead of time when something like this happens and let them know so that they can be informed, that we can help inform the medical community as parents. I really find that very empowering, and it's a clear message that you're offering today. So thank you for that.
Sure.
Wonderful. So we're at the end of our time together for today. Is there anything that you'd like to say, Pam, as I bring this to a close?
I just want to thank the parents for all that you're doing, and I look forward to more of these calls with more questions and different foci, and encourage you to be building relationships with providers, knowing that in the spring we are hoping to do a medical provider course for physicians, nurses, medical assistants, physical therapists, anyone in the medical profession to learn these tools as providers.
Yes, absolutely. We do offer a professionals intensive, which begins the last week of March. So those of you who registered for this talk will receive an email with a link to a replay of this talk. And we would love it if you would forward this link to your doctor, your child's pediatrician, and invite them to learn more about these tools and also to listen in on these upcoming talks by Pam. And Hand in Hand offers a number of resources in addition to this. We offer free resources, including articles, podcasts, membership to a free Yahoo discussion group, and access to a blog. We offer one-on-one consultations. We have self-guided classes with topics ranging from helping children with aggression to sleep to sibling rivalry. And they're self-guided, which means that you'll be watching videos and reading booklets on your own at your own pace and time. And the course also comes with optional consultation time. And we also offer an instructor-led 6-week-long starter class. And these are wonderful ways to be introduced to parenting by connection. It's the best way to learn about the approach and the supportive environment of an instructor and a few other parents. In addition, lastly, we also offer a 10-week-long parenting intensive, and we really encourage you to look at the website handinhandparenting.com to find out more about these wonderful offerings. And I also want to thank you so much for joining us today and for all of the work and love that you're shining on your children each and every day. Thank you so much. Thank you, Pam, for being here today to share your wisdom and your experience with us using these tools as a pediatrician and also as a mother. Thank you so much for coming and for the talks that you'll be sharing with us in the future as well. I really look forward to them.
Thanks, Jackie. It was fun doing this with you.
You too. Wonderful. I hope everyone has a wonderful holiday season and lots of loving connection with your children into the days and weeks ahead. Take good care. Bye-bye.